I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Outside of nursing, women were rare in the medical field at the turn of the 20th century. That makes the legacy of sisters Alice Berry Graham and Catherine Berry Richardson even more special. One was a surgeon, the other a dentist, and they wanted to serve Kansas City's neediest kids. Today we learn the history of the local institution they built together, Children's Mercy Hospital. Then a musical institution, Kansas City's Deborah Brown has been called a singer's singer with mind-boggling technique. Early in her career, Brown moved to Europe and toured worldwide. Now she's home. We'll find out what brought her back. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. It took a pair of sisters to launch Children's Mercy Hospital. It was when one of those sisters rescued a crippled little girl from the mean streets of our city back in the 1890s that the idea of launching a place where kids could be helped took root. Today, of course, Children's Mercy is a major medical and research center that has cared for tens of thousands of kids over the decades. Thomas McCormally has written a new history of the hospital titled For All Children Everywhere. He has worked in the PR department at the hospital since 1994 and is the hospital's first director of archives. Tom, so good to have you here. Welcome.
Great. Thanks, Steve. Good to be here.
And just for the record, I should say Children's Mercy helped my own newborn first son after he was born prematurely. Tell us about these sisters, Tom, Alice Berry Graham and Catherine Berry Richardson. They started this hospital. How did it come to pass that they wound up in Kansas City? Because they weren't born here.
No, they were actually born in Pennsylvania. One of them was born in Pennsylvania. One of them was born in Kentucky. The story goes that they flipped a coin when Catherine had graduated from medical school in Philadelphia, flipped a coin to decide where to move. That coin landed on La Crosse, Wisconsin. And from there, exactly how they ended up in Kansas City, we don't know. Catherine got married in 1893. She went on her honeymoon, which we believe may have included Kansas City. And I think they saw the opportunity in this bustling cow town.
You wonder about the connection here, Philadelphia, La Crosse, Wisconsin,
right,
and Kansas City. But they were raised with some very solid values.
Very solid values. And it's attributed to their dad, Stephen Berry, who taught them that it was their responsibility to take care of their fellow citizens and to do good. And particularly,
the golden rule was very much emphasized
the golden
in that household.
Rule and to care for children other than their own. And actually, neither one of the sisters had children of their own. But even before they knew that, their father instilled in them that anybody can take care of their own kids. We're expected to do that. But a true star will take care of other people's children.
And Dad had a difficult life of his own, didn't he?
Oh, yes. I mean, Dad was a Northern sympathizer living in Kentucky during the Civil War. He got run out of Kentucky, and so he had to leave his family, three daughters and a wife in Kentucky, while he served in the Union Army.
But clearly a man of principle just from that one story alone.
Absolutely, and really a strong belief in his family, and taught the girls set them on a path to take care of others.
The other thing that struck me, and this was maybe almost more common back in the old days than it is these days, but these two sisters, Alice and Catherine, utterly devoted to each other in a way that I guess you still see it today, but maybe not as often.
Oh, absolutely. And I think part of that had to do with when Alice was about 10 years older than Catherine, and their mom died when Alice would have been 11 or 12, and I believe she probably helped take care of the girls because a 12-year-old in the 1880s would have had that responsibility. And so that helped them bond. But yes, they made a pact that one of them would work while the other one went to school. And then when Catherine got out of school, they turned the tables and she worked so Alice could go to dental school.
I was going to say, Catherine became a doctor and Alice became a dentist. That was their career trajectories here.
That's right. And actually, and Catherine became a surgeon. And remember, this was a time when there were only one or two places in the country where women could get medical education. Women weren't allowed in the medical societies. I mean, women couldn't vote. Women couldn't own property. These were a couple of really strong ladies.
I was going to say they were pioneers, and men in those days weren't happy with the idea that women wanted to become medical professionals.
Oh no, absolutely. And even when they got to Kansas City, there was a cartoon mocking the sisters in the Kansas City Star in the 1890s that, you know, no men allowed at this hospital. And so they were pretty well shunned. And so that's how they ended up focusing on the children, the poor children of Kansas City, who were neglected by everything in society.
I guess this notion that the dad really emphasized service and helping kids, doing unto others, that idea led to them becoming a doctor and a dentist?
Yes, absolutely. And when Alice was in dental school, she would take whatever spare money she had and would contribute to children's causes in Philadelphia. So this was instilled in them. And when they got here, they saw the great need of these children being abandoned on the streets, children being abused.
Catherine became pretty insightful, Tom, about her specialty, which involved pregnancy. At the time, even back in the day, she rejected the idea that expecting mothers should just lie around in bed all the time. It was ahead of her time.
That's right. Well, and that's actually just the beginning of her innovation and her challenging of the norm. She was a leader in believing in sun therapy and making sure that the children had fresh air at the hospital. She was a believer at a time when we didn't know how dangerous germs were. She believed in making sure that surgeons washed their hands, which, believe it or not, there was a time when surgeons didn't bother to wash their hands.
I think James Garfield, our former president, Candace Millard, writes in her book, that's one reason he died, was because people didn't know how to be clean, taking care of the ailing president.
So it was that kind of innovation. And then actually that just kept pushing her to make changes to the hospital, to hire the people that she did. She sent one of her nurses to the Swiss Alps to study in the 1920s at a time when the hospital had very few resources, but she knew if we do the research, we can help take care of children better.
That's interesting. We're talking about the origins of Children's Mercy Hospital and its history with Thomas McCormley, who has a new book out, For All Children Everywhere. So let's go back to the 1890s and this seminal moment in terms of the history of Children's Mercy, Tom. Alice rescued what you described as a crippled little girl from the dirty streets of Kansas City. What do we know about that moment and about that incident?
Well, there's two or three different stories that revolve around that time. What we believe happened is that Alice was contacted by a bar owner in the West Bottoms who either saw this little girl or knew of this little girl whose mom was trying to give her away. The mom couldn't take care of her. And so Alice went and picked her up and took her home. And at the time, they were living at about 9th and Main Street in the Old Ridge Building downtown. Eventually, they rented a bed in the Women's and Children's Hospital at 15th and Cleveland, which is about where the old Sears warehouse is now, the postal warehouse. They're off of I-70, and in a ramshackle old two-story house, a lumber yard across the street, train tracks running right next to it, and this served as the first bed, the first place for Children's Mercy.
And we think, is that what happened, or are there other stories as well?
No, that were pretty well. The details that are just kind of shady is, how did Alice find out about this child? And was the child in the back room of a bar room, or was she on the streets? Those are the things. But we absolutely know about the hospital existed, and we knew that the sisters worked with the three or four women physicians who were running the women's hospital at the time. And there was actually a lawsuit that as Children's Mercy grew, and began taking more of the resources from that, or demanding more of the resources, more of the space in that women's hospital, that there was a legal battle, and Alice served as the corporation's attorney, and eventually the two sides just split up in the early 1900s.
How pivotal to the creation of the hospital was this moment?
Well, this was absolutely a time when once they got the child into the bed at the Women and Children's Hospital, Alice looked at Catherine that night and said, somebody needs to take better care of these children. And Catherine, you and I are the ones to do that. So this truly was the beginning of the hospital.
You know, it goes without saying, this was way before the time of Medicare, way before the time of Medicaid and CHIP and all these other programs that are aimed at helping kids. How did they afford this? How did they pay for it?
They were unrelenting in asking for help. And they had a newsletter that they sent out.
Sort of like Operation Breakthrough today.
Exactly.
Ways, yeah.
And in fact, one of the things that gets lost in this is Children's Mercy didn't charge anything, didn't even take patients who could pay until the 1950s.
Wow.
So for the first 50-some years of the hospital, only poor children and children who could not pay were admitted to Children's Mercy. If a child or their family had money, they would go to one of the other hospitals in town.
Were all kinds of poor kids? Did it matter what kind of illness you were suffering from, or were all kids brought in?
All kids were brought in, and kids from a long way away. We have stories of children from North Dakota, from New Mexico, and that was because Alice particularly made sure that the hospital was what she called non-local. She wanted to take care of all children. And the only children who they couldn't take care of were African-American children. And
that's
because we were a very segregated society at the time. And as much as they wanted to, they couldn't take care of the African-American children because if the fear that if they allowed the African-American children at the hospital, that the funding would dry up. That the people would just not support it.
But obviously, at one point, that changed.
It changed. And, well, in the 1920s, Catherine got to know a doctor by the name of James Perry, who ran what was known as Wheatley Provident Hospital. That's basically at 18th and Troost. The building is still standing today at 18th and Troost. It was owned by the African-American community. And Catherine worked with him to establish a training program for African-American doctors and nurses, which at the time was the only hospital-based training program for African-American doctors and nurses in the country. And it was at that time, once they established that program, with the help of some very well-heeled Kansas City businessmen, that Catherine was able to say, I can now say that Children's Mercy is for all children everywhere.
Which is the title of the book.
Right.
Yeah. I should point out that Tom will be speaking at 2 o'clock on Sunday at the Central Library downtown. More information, kclibrary.org. Again, his new book, For All Children Everywhere. You know, it's just staggering to me as I was going through the book last night, just how far ahead of the curve these two women were. And you wonder, what was it in them that allowed them to have the kind of foresight they had?
It was amazing drive. I mean, as I said, Catherine was a surgeon, which was pretty unheard of. She was admitted to the American College of Surgeons in the 1920s. And actually, there's a series of photos in the book of some before and after slides of the work she did on cleft lip and cleft palate.
Yes, I saw that.
Stunning to look at. Mm-hmm. From these pictures that are 100 years old, and they show just amazing work. And I think the fact that she was never satisfied, she was always pushing to do better. One of her dying wishes was that we establish a research program at Children's Mercy.
Which, of course, has also happened.
Which has also happened and has for years. And then there was the big announcement a couple of weeks ago of our new Children's Research Institute building to help, you know, bring her dreams even more to reality.
And $150 million in donations from two great families in the Kansas City area.
And that's one of the things that is amazing. And I tried to make the point in the book that we have relied on the generosity of this community forever. And whenever things seemed that we were at the end of our rope and we were running out of money, things would just happen and this community would come through. And that started in the 1890s and it continues today.
How long, Tom, were Catherine and Alice involved in the hospital?
So Alice died in 1913. So Alice never even got to see the hospital up on Independence Avenue that opened in 1917. And Catherine worked up until the day before she died in 1933. So a long time.
How are the two remembered today?
Well, one of the reasons why we wanted to write the book is to make sure that they're remembered. Around Children's Mercy and the people who know the story, they are just revered for this legacy of of never stopping our efforts to care for kids and to do what we absolutely can to just love them the best that we possibly can.
But no statue.
There's no statue.
Should there be?
I don't know if Catherine would want a statue, because one of the things she said near the end of her life was that, you know, if I can be a force for good, that's what I want to be remembered for. And they do have their grave site out at Mount Washington Cemetery, where the two sisters are buried. And that's a pretty nice tribute to them. And we try to visit, take employees out there every now and then to just remember where we came from.
You know, no question that the two of them had this drive. They had a vision. They were going to get it done. And you can't help but wonder what it might have been like to work for the two of them, because you get the sense they were just whirling dervishes and they were going this way. And if you weren't with them, then maybe that might be a problem.
Well, absolutely. More than one person who worked with them referred to Catherine as a dictator. So I saw that written down more than once.
Yeah, I get the impression. Yeah, I get the idea.
Well, and there's a story about William Rockhill Nelson, who was at the Kansas City Star.
I was going to ask you, there's a little box you had in the book about this. Yeah.
And he just wondered, he says, you're getting an awful lot of free publicity from my newspaper.
He called them up to his office,
yes,
right?
Called Catherine up to his office and said, come in here. And she went in. She wasn't shy of this man. And she said, if you want to check me out, feel free to check me out. And
she wasn't sure who she was, that this person getting all this attention, and wanted to make sure she was on the up and up, right?
Right, exactly. It was just so unheard of. And here are these women, and women didn't have much of a place in society at that time. So Nelson did some investigating and decided, yep, they were legit. And I believe it was in the 1920s, there was like a Sunday magazine piece about Catherine and referred to her as the most successful woman in Kansas City.
Wow, amazing. Let's go to some a call here. Nancy from Drexel. Nancy, good morning.
Hi, yeah. I can sing Mercy's praises. My sister back in the 40s, she accidentally swallowed a solution of lye and water. It burned her esophagus to the point that the scar tissue drew up and nothing would go down. She almost died of malnutrition before we could get her to Mercy Hospital. And we took the train and the streetcar to get there to visit her. That was in the old location. But they saved her life. They cut a hole in her stomach and fed her through a tube. And then they put a string down her throat and taped on the side of her face. And every so often they would draw a bead down this string, and they kept getting it bigger each time. And it was a very painful procedure for her, but it was their attempt to try to open her esophagus so she could eat. So they'd saved her life.
Well, Nancy, it's a great story. I'm glad you shared it with us.
And yes, thank you.
You've heard a lot of these stories, Tom.
I've heard a lot of these stories, and I think this is one, a testament of the fact that it was a place of last resort for people, and we took all comers from all around Kansas and Missouri, and like I said, New Mexico, North Dakota, Iowa, and it was nice that we were able to be there for those families.
Remind us that the present location of the hospital was not the original location of the hospital. Just trace where it's been in the city.
That's
and
right.
When it landed on Hospital Hill.
So the hospital, like I said, started over at 15th and Cleveland, and then moved to a building at 11th and Troost. Both of those buildings, of course, are gone. And then was at 414 Highland, which is just north of Independence Avenue, right at about Paseo.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a beautiful old home that served for about 15 years.
Is that building still there?
That building is not there. It's been replaced by some apartments.
Mm-hmm.
And then just about four blocks away from there was the building at Independence and Paseo that is still standing today. It's the University of Medicine, Kansas City University.
Right.
And it served as our home from 1917 until 1970. And in 1970, we moved to Hospital Hill. And at that time, Hospital Hill was, you know, kind of in its early stages as this place in Kansas City for public health. And that's where we've stayed primarily, although we now have locations in Overland Park and Independence and Northland and out in Wyandotte County and Joplin, Wichita. But the main campus, what we call the Adele Hall campus, mm-hmm. is on Hospital Hill. And it's pretty sprawling from what it was. It was one little building. And for people who remember that time, Old General Hospital was up there on Hospital Hill. And over time, we knocked down different parts of that building and eventually have taken up all of that space.
You know, I always have this thought when we do segments like this on some of the great early historical figures in Kansas City, and you wonder what Catherine and Alice would think if they could see it today and how pleased I'm sure they would be with what's happened here.
Right. I can't imagine that they have any idea how big we could have grown. Mm. And what the future holds. But I know they would be pleased to know that Kansas City has continued to support the children and their families, and to see the 8,000 employees at Children's Mercy today who are all out there remembering those sisters and trying to do our best we can to live their legacy.
That's Thomas McCormally. Again, his new book, For All Children Everywhere, it's the history of Children's Mercy Hospital. He'll be speaking at 2 on Sunday at the Central Library downtown. More information, kclibrary.org. Tom, thanks for a great conversation. Congratulations on the book.
Absolutely. Thank you, Steve. Good to be here.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk with one of the great jazz crooners in Kansas City, Deborah Brown. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On yesterday's show, local voters gave us their ratings on President Trump's first year in office. You can hear that conversation and more by visiting us at kcur.org/uptodate. On Monday, I get to talk journalism with NPR correspondent Wade Goodwin, who will be in town, plus the actor pulling off an amazing string of one-man shows. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, here's the deal with singer Deborah Brown. She's a headline jazz performer in Sweden, Italy, Russia, and Israel, and did I mention Senegal? But she's not all that well-known around Kansas City, which happens to be her hometown. That's been the storyline on Deborah for years. Now we'll attempt to unlock the mystery of Deborah Brown. She performs at Johnson County Community College this weekend, and here she is singing Lullaby of Birdland from 2016's Kansas City, Here I Come.
One, two, three.
That's the great Deborah Brown singing Lullaby of Birdland from her latest disc, 2016's Kansas City, Here I Come. And welcome back. So good to have you here again.
Thank you so much, Steve. It's good to be here.
You know, I was checking last night. The last time you were here, I think, was in 2010. That's just wrong. It's been too long.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you travel, people always ask you this, you travel to all these distant lands to perform. One of them has been Senegal. Is it different performing in Senegal than it is at the Blue Room in Kansas City?
Well,
what's
I guess
different
you could
about
say
it?
What's different?
Yeah.
I want people to understand about jazz music. People that love jazz and come to the concerts, they're so enthusiastic. It doesn't really, there's no difference in the audience.
That's amazing.
From Florida to Kansas City to New York to Holland to some room in Senegal. If people love jazz, to me, it's all the same reaction. It's very strange. It's really an international music.
No kidding. Mm-hmm. Well, you moved to Europe in 1985 from the States. What was it that took you there at that time?
Honestly?
Yeah.
Honestly, I was really afraid of the drug craze, and I was afraid that somehow it would affect me in some way.
What do you mean?
Well, Richard Pryor actually had been burned, and with something they were calling freebasing. I right. had no idea what that was. And I know I probably shouldn't say this on radio, but I tell you, a good friend of mine that really wasn't involved in the drug culture said, "Deborah, something really strange is happening in America." I said, "What do you mean?" She said, "Come and go with me, and we're going to get in the car, and we're going to visit a few of my friends." Every door we went to, everyone was behind the door. It was very suspicious. They answered the door like, "Who is it?" And I was like, "Oh, what is going on here?" And you'd come in, and they go, "Oh, hey, girl, come on in." And there would be people there doing this freebasing thing, and that scared me to death. And it scared my friend. And we went in completely opposite directions. She went in a different direction. I went to Europe, and that's the reason why I went to Europe.
And you didn't find the same problem in Europe, it doesn't sound like.
No.
Yeah. Mm-mm. But there's a different culture in Europe when it comes to music and jazz. What did you find there that was different than what was going on here, just when it came to appreciation for what you were doing?
Well, first of all, if you say that you're a singer, you're a musician in jazz music, people there say, in Europe say, "Well, I know there's a place where you can play." However, in America, if you say that same thing, people say, "Oh, yeah, but what do you really do for a living?" That's kind of the difference. The other thing, too, that I find is music is just a profession, just the same as going to work in a factory, you know, or working with woodwork or going to, you know, be a radio announcer. It's a profession. So they take it very seriously. So they're trained very well. I find that interesting.
Does it bother you about America that our attitude is what it is?
No, because this is a country where people really look up to, this is where everything is happening as far as music is concerned. Like Elton John, when Elton John said, "Well, you know, I want to do my last concerts in America because this is where I made it." This is how people around the world feel about music in America. And that's not only in rock and roll, but that's also in jazz.
But you still have this reputation as being more popular in Europe than here. Does that dig at you a little bit?
I think that was someone that wrote that in a newspaper, and just like your...
It just stayed with you.
It just kind of stayed with me, but I don't feel like I'm any less known than any other artist here.
Yeah. I was so struck when you were in Europe about the number of jazz greats who were living over there at the time. Listen to this list. Clark Terry, Horace Parlan, Red Mitchell, Egg Thigpen, just great names in the world of jazz. And, of course, that pattern of great American jazz players had been going on for decades by that point. Dexter Gordon is someone who had lived over there for years. Ben Webster, who was born here in Kansas City, had to. So to what extent do you form your own community over there of ex-jazz pats, I guess? There must be a lot of them.
Right. And I was thinking about Thad Jones, too. You know, he's an arranger. There was a lot of arrangers. Quincy Jones was there. They bought the expat community together to work and play there. And it's much more simple than bringing everyone from the United States, because it costs a lot of money to bring them overseas. Mm-hmm. But I find that when you get there, everyone knows everyone. There is an established community there. And so all of a sudden, these people that you could never find in America, let alone talk with them, all of a sudden, there you are in the middle of this great group of musicians that I was, you know, I was able to perform with, and get advice with. That would have never happened in America. I mean, it would have, because I did know Count Basie, and I did speak with him, as well as many other people, too, here in America. But there it was really much more of an intimate setting where you could actually talk about music, where you could actually have a relationship, have a cup of coffee, and a drink.
Yeah. Tell me about Count Basie.
Count Basie
would have loved to have met him.
You know, Count Basie, when I met him at the Charlie Parker Foundation, He said, you know, I can't get out of this. I can't stop. You know, I can't stop working. They won't let me. And I thought, he sounded like a prisoner in a way. I know that sounds very strange.
Right.
But when you get to a certain age, you do get tired of traveling. You love what you do, love being on stage, but you got to pack bags, and no matter if somebody has to pack them for you. He sounded like he was a little bit weary, but he knew that there was a lot of people riding on the fact that he still could be out there. And that, to me, felt a little bit scary. On the other hand, Count Basie said yes to everything. Count Basie never said no, because he felt like that was just a negativity thing. He was very positive, and he would say things like, well, you think I could do this? Can I join you for this concert? Yeah, cool, baby. One of my friends, one of my young friends, wrote a song called Cool Baby because of that statement. But yeah, he was very accommodating.
And you played with Clark Terry, just a personal favorite. Again, lots of connections to Kansas City. I read somewhere you tell a great story about Clark being a headliner at a concert and being late. He was held up for some reason, and all these other great players sort of being held hostage in a sense because Clark wasn't there yet to sort of lead the way forward. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's what we call pecking order in the jazz business. But that pecking order was very, very important because nobody wanted to take the lead because of Clark Terry was coming, and he was the big guy. And I'm looking at all of these jazz greats, like, you know, Harry Sweets Edison. Ed Thigpen was there. Kenny Drew, the great pianist. Jimmy Woody was on the bass. And it was just an amazing to see these guys. Well, we're not going to figure out anything until Clark gets here. Yeah. And I'm like, he's not going to be here until like 30 minutes before the concert. But when he did come, and it was more than 30 minutes before the concert, everybody just snapped too. Yeah. We put the show together, and that was the way it was. And me, as the lowest one on the totem pole, to speak.
Well, you know, you're known as a great scat singer, and so was Clark Terry, who did his famous song called Mumbles, which I've heard him, fortunately, I heard him do, I think, more than once. Did you ever do that with him?
Oh, I did it in New York with him.
Really?
He came, he was in a wheelchair at that time. Mm. I was in New York. We were at the International Association of Jazz Educators. I had a performance there with my band, and at the end of the show, his wife wheels him up in front, and he starts, "Hey, Deborah," and the crowd went crazy. I'll never forget it. Kevin Mahogany was there, too, at that performance.
We're going to talk about Kevin Mahogany in just a moment. The great jazz singer Deborah Brown is with us. She performs this Sunday evening at Johnson County, the Community College at 7 as part of the college's Winterlude series. Tickets, jcc.edu/Carlson Center. When you were over in Europe, was it like you were starting your jazz career all over again?
Yeah, I guess you could say it was. When I went there, I had some big band charts that I'd performed in, in Las Vegas, because I'd worked in a jazz band, jazz big band in Las Vegas at the Sahara, and I took that over with me, and I was able to do a lot of radio programs with big bands over there. So yeah, it was opening up the door. I really didn't want to. I did a lot of different kind of music when I was in the States. When I went over there, I really just concentrated on jazz.
You know, maybe a dumb question, but does the language get in the way when you're singing English lyrics and you're in foreign countries?
People love to hear English, and they really hate to hear me sing their language.
Really? Why? Because you can't do it very well?
I can slaughter it pretty good.
So stick with English, Deborah. That just works better, right?
I have been told on several occasions, it's okay, Miss Brown, you don't have to sing in our language.
Don't bother.
Like, wait a minute, are you kidding? I work so hard on this.
Don't make things more complicated. Well, let's hear some more music. Here's Deborah Brown performing Pannonica. Mm-hmm. Am I saying it right? Pannonica from 2016's Kansas City, Here I Come.
Softer than silk, and as warm milk, light as air and able to fly. Blossoms noblest, while they're waiting for a kiss, Pannonica, my butterfly. Fluttering one, fair and bright as the sun, light as wind embracing the sky. Colorful wings, soft and gaily painted things, Pannonica, my butterfly. One day she'll flutter by, can't describe, though they try. Love played a tune when she stepped from.
That's Deborah Brown. She performs at 7 Sunday night at Johnson County Community College. You know, you're known for your great phrasing. What does that mean? Translate that word to people like me who don't really understand the nuts and bolts of all this stuff.
Well, how I explain it to my students is you'll have a group of words like in poetry, and people will say, Mary had a little lamb, its fleece was white as snow.
Right.
So that is the pattern. That is the pattern of that particular poem. But I would say that everyone has a different way of thinking about things. So I would say something like, Mary had a little lamb, his fleece was white as snow.
Oh, there you go.
So that's different phrasing.
Yeah. Okay. When you travel overseas and you tell people you're from Kansas City, what do they say to you?
People know about Kansas City. They know it's a jazz town, but they have no idea that we still have the kind of activity in our jazz community. It's more clubs and places that play jazz than any place I've ever lived.
Yeah, you were. I just read that you said that the other day. So we're still humming pretty good on the jazz front as far as you're concerned.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah.
We're at the top right now.
Yeah. Got the new Green Lady Lounge and the Black Dolphin next door, which is a club that everyone's raving about downtown. It's you know, it's just interesting what's going on out there.
Right. You have so many things. You got the American Jazz Museum. The Blue Room. You've got even very obscure places, little tiny places that no one would think there was music, but you could go there and hear a lunch concert, or, you know, there's so many different places here.
Yeah. Why did you gravitate towards music in your life?
I think it's something I was born with.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what it is, and
so
I didn't realize
early
it.
On you were going this way.
Well, no, not exactly. I think when I was like 10 or 11 years old, there was a kid and we were doing share things at the school. And I got up and shared a song, which is what we did at home. And I sat down and one of the classmates says, hey, you can sing. And I went, I can. So
that was the light bulb moment.
That was a light bulb moment.
Yeah.
And then my choir conductor in high school took a special interest and knew that I was very interested in music. And so I was, you know, I was aided to help, get me into college early by taking some courses at UMKC a little earlier before I graduated from school. I was a part of a theater group called Carnes down on Fifth Street, where we did plays for underprivileged kids or a lot of schools in the area.
Yeah.
So that was a great experience for me. So it was just natural.
When was the first time you thought, you know, I could do this professionally? I could make a living doing this?
When I got my first job.
Which was?
At Six Flags over Mid-America.
Oh, really?
Outside of St. Louis.
Yeah.
I begged my parents if I could go there and audition, and they said yes. And I went there for my summer job after my first year of university.
And what did you sing at Six Flags?
Well, I did Hello, Dolly. That was my featured number in the show.
Uh-huh.
And people would come in. We'd do 5 shows a day. People would come in. My part, we did a chorus line, and then we did Hello, Dolly. I came out of a big balloon from the top of the theater stage. It was a big theater stage. And I came down and had a really fancy costume on and had some cute little quips. And that was it. I mean, I caught the bug.
You know, you hit the road early in your life. And once you opened for George Carlin in Las Vegas, what do you remember from that?
Oh, that was amazing. He was so humble and such a funny guy.
Good guy.
And I remember most is his dressing room, because at the dressing room, all of his friends that were comedians would come by and try out their material on him. They wanted to know what he thought about his material. So I saw a lot of comedians there.
Was he honest with them about their stuff?
No.
You know,
I mean, I don't know if he was honest or not, but he would, you know, he would just like, you know, smile and laugh, and, you know, they would know that their material was okay. Another person there was, never mind. I had a moment where I can remember.
How many months of the year are you in Kansas City these days, and how many months of the year are you overseas?
Well, I travel to Europe generally about 8 times a year.
8 times?
Yeah.
Wow.
I know that's a lot, almost every other month or so.
You know, you lived in Belgium?
I lived in Belgium for 2 years.
Yeah.
I lived in Holland for 8.
Yeah.
I taught there at the university, at their conservatory of music, and for 7 years, and that kept me legal there. Mm-hmm. And
how big of an adjustment was it going to live in Europe after a lifetime?
It was a huge adjustment because I normally just go and don't even think about it before. Because if I had spent any time thinking about it, I probably wouldn't have gone.
Right.
But I went there on vacation, and I found it that, and I visited a friend of mine that was a singer, and I met a musician at a party. And when I went there at the party, they had beautiful food there, round loaves of bread, baked figs, things that I just wasn't familiar with. And then I saw a picture of a Picasso on the wall, and I thought, seriously? And then I asked my friend later, I said, do you think I should move to Europe? You think I'd be crazy to do that? She said, you'd be crazy not to.
Why not, right?
Why not?
Yeah.
She loved it, and she was successful there. And I thought, well, maybe, you know, this is the next move for me.
I'm talking with jazz singer Deborah Brown. I wanted to ask you about an old buddy of yours who just passed away. You've already mentioned him here today. Kevin Mahogany, another great jazz singer from Kansas City. That one hurt.
That was a true success story. He called me. He called me when I was first going to Europe, and he said, Deborah, I'd like to come to Europe. And I said, sure, you know, you can come. Several people came from Kansas City, and Richard Ross was another one of them that came and lived with us for almost a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea was, you know, they get their career started and go off on their own. And I told Kevin that he was welcome to come, but I had not realized until years later when he told me, he said, I didn't have a kind of a ticket to go to Europe. And I thought if you just said something, we could have figured something out.
Yeah.
But because he didn't come, he got a great record contract, and that put him on the map.
Yeah, right, right. Well, what could he do as a singer that you admired? What was it about Kevin that...
You know, Kevin had a very powerful voice.
Yes, he did.
But he had such a gentle way of singing that always surprised me. And it always surprised me, the gentleness.
Yeah. Let's listen to Kevin Mahogany and Deborah Brown together. This is Teach Me Tonight from, again, Kansas City, Here I Come.
Did you say I've got a lot to learn? Well, don't think I'm trying not to learn. Since this is the perfect spot to learn, teach me tonight.
Starting with the ABC of it, right down to the XYZ of it. Help me solve the mystery of it. Teach me tonight.
The sky's a blackboard high up above you. And if a shooting star goes by,
I'll use that star to write I love you. 1,000 times across the sky.
One thing isn't very clear, my love. Should the teacher stand so near, my love? With graduation almost here, my love.
Kevin Mahogany, Deborah Brown singing Teach Me Tonight. It's pretty nice.
That was
Sound
fun.
Good.
Yeah, that was fun.
Are you okay listening
time.
To yourself? Or is that a silly question after all these years?
Well, no, I have learned to relax when listening to myself.
Yeah.
No, it is difficult to listen to yourself, but you have to listen to it so much that you become comfortable with it.
You once said that anyone can sing, but not everyone can sing so that it affects someone's life. What did you mean by that?
Well, it's just like my sister tells me, all of us in our family can sing, but I'm the only one that gets paid for it.
That's the difference, right? Clearly you're doing something right, right? Yeah. You've got a big concert coming up in Sweden. What is that?
Well, they called and asked for a program, and I guess it's because of the the jazz festival that we did there. We took the Leopoldinum Orchestra, just what you're hearing on the record, and we took them to Sweden, and it was a huge success. So the concert hall in Stockholm, the same place where they have the Nobel Prize. They called and asked for a program, and I said, what do you want? Sure, I'll bring you something. And they said, anyone that you'd like to sing with. And I thought, wow, that's amazing. So I put together a group, and then they said, well, do you think you might want to have a guest artist? And who would it be? Immediately I said, well, you know, Bobby Watson.
Yeah, why not? And you're going to Sweden with Bobby Watson.
So we're going.
Yeah. What should fans expect to hear from your show at Johnson County Community College Sunday night? What are you doing?
We are going to have a lot of fun.
Yeah.
We have the rehearsals, and the guitarist is going to be with us, Rob Fleeman, and he's absolutely Rod Fleeman, excuse me.
Yeah.
And he's absolutely wonderful.
Yes, he
the
is.
Whole band, everybody on their instruments, just an artist. So it's going to be a lot of laughs, a lot of fun. I think whenever people come to hear us, they realize it's just fun.
You know, it's always great to have you here. We'll look forward to seeing you on Sunday night, and thanks for dropping by again, okay?
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'll be with the symphony as well.
That's good.
Mm-hmm.
When's that going to be?
That's going to be February 9th through the 11th.
Wow.
And they have tickets available, and I think the best chance is the Sunday afternoon concert at 2 p.m.
Okay. Let's go out with one more track from Deborah Brown. This is What Is This Thing Called Love from way back in 1988, the album Jazz for Jazz. On Monday, a conversation with NPR correspondent Wade Goodwin. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.
Should it make a fool of